Okay, I've turned the recorder on. Today is Wednesday, October 10th, 2012. This is George Cusis, graduate student at the University of Texas at Austin, H.J. Lutcher Stark Center for Physical Culture and Sports. As a part of the 1968 U.S. Olympic Team Oral History Project, I am interviewing Bill Latsko over the phone about his experiences in the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City. And Dr. Latsko, again, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to talk with us.
My pleasure.
If you would, just to start us off, tell us a little bit about your childhood. When and where were you born, and what was life like?
I was born in Reit, R-H-E-Y-D-T, Germany, because my father, an Austrian, was working there. I came to the United States in 1939. At the age of 10, and the rest of my life was spent here. When I went to college, I was offered an opportunity to learn how to fence and jumped at it, became the team captain and manager of the team, and fencing has been the love of my life ever since.
Mm-hmm. And when you came to the States, where exactly did you settle down?
We came to New York first and lived in New York for a while.
Okay.
And then went to Connecticut. And after I got married, I lived in a variety of places, mostly in New Jersey and North Bergen at the moment.
Now, you noted that you'd got some experience fencing in college. Where had you attended university?
Fordham University.
Okay. And you didn't have a lot of experience with fencing before that. Were there any? I mean, was that big?
No, that was my first encounter.
How did you get involved there?
At freshman year, Fordham was restarting after World War II, and the at that time freshmen could actually compete in varsity.
Mm-hmm.
So the coach, Dr. Winters, got a group of us together and showed us some preliminary things. And 1 week later, we went up to West Point to fence against them. And it was a disaster because West Point was the best team around at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And we were not particularly good. However, with some luck, I managed to win one bout.
Uh-huh. And what was it that drew you to the sport most?
What drew me to the sport? Well, I read The Three Musketeers, as a lot of people did, and I thought it was interesting.
Yeah.
Fencing sounded like fun,
uh-huh.
And it was.
And if you would take us kind of through your career thereafter, how did you get involved with USA Fencing?
Well, I was a member of USA Fencing when I joined in college,
mm-hmm.
and I've been a member ever since. In fact, I'm a life member of it now. The organization is the one that sponsored all the regular fencing, local fencing, national fencing, and Olympic fencing. I became very much involved with fencing. I was asked to do some work. I learned how to become an armorer because the current armorer was retiring, and I kind of had a feeling for the electric weapons. Epee was the only one in those days. And so I learned how to do it with Costello. We were the team armorer for the USF, what is now USFA. At the time, it was the Amateur Fencers League of America.
And in the year leading up to the games, what exactly were you doing? Where were you living, and were you working?
Well, I was working in a number of places. First, I had a little tour in Korea. I was in the Army Reserve, an officer in the Army Reserve, and I got called up. Did a 2-year stint in active duty.
Mm-hmm.
And in Korea, I found there were no people in my unit that could fence, so on R&R in Japan. I bought some swords and some masks and began a fencing team. Fairly successful until the sword broke, and that was the end of it. Came back to the United States, ultimately discharged, and found job as a chemist. I had studied chemistry in college, took a master's degree in management, and changed a few jobs. Worked for Dixon Crucible Company, Alpha Metals, then Joseph Mundet, Court Company, and finally for Columbia Record Club, where I was hired as a statistician, and I worked there for many years. And during the 1968 Olympics, I was engaged at the Columbia Record Club, part of CBS.
And then you went on to do your PhD after that then?
Yes, I did. When I was in Columbia, I went to NYU and studied under W. Edward Deming and did everything except my dissertation, which was kind of sad because suddenly the amount of time I had to spend away from home was a great deal.
Sure.
Then for a couple of years, I just let that go and finally went back again and got my PhD.
Now, how did your becoming team manager for the 68 team come about?
Well, I was involved in the USFA administration. I was secretary of the organization. And as such, I was involved very heavily in the training and in the preparation and selection of the team. And as part of the selection, I was selected as the manager of the team, the 1968 team. And that gave me the job, really, of finalizing everything and training the team once it was selected and getting it to Mexico City. And from that point on, I was the father and mother of the team.
Could you take us through that Olympic trials experience? What was that process like?
We had a very formal process for Olympic trials. It amounted to a point system where competitors were basically working and trying to get as many points as they can, and those with the highest points were selected for the team. It was strictly a competition, quite similar to athletics and some of the other competitions. We tried to select the best possible members, and once they were selected, then there was further training. So the selection of the team was based on points. The selection of the staff was based on members of the team. We took coaches that had a number of members on the team. The armorer, Dan DeShane, was selected on the basis of his abilities. And the team captain, who actually worked for the manager, Norman Lewis, was the president. It was normal that the president of the USFA became the team captain, which is a position during the competition where the team captain looks after the team itself.
And it seemed like a fairly large squad when I looked at the number of athletes. How many did you have?
20 fencers and 5 staff.
Was that pretty typical for a fencing team at the Olympics?
Yes, at that time it was. Later on, that became cut down a lot. But at that time, that was a typical team category and team. You had 4 members in each event, but that in 1968, there were only 4 events: the épée, foil, saber, and women's foil. Today, of course, there's a lot more because we have women in every sport. So 1968, we had four members on each team, and five members. We had four plus an alternate, so that made 20 competitive members and the five cadre.
Now, a lot has been made about the altitude in Mexico City. Was that something that fencers had to deal with too?
Yes, we did. Several things were done. First of all, three of the epi-fencers were also pentathletes, modern pentathlon.
Wow.
And those three trained with the pentathlon, I believe it was at the Air Force Academy. They even went up higher in order to get altitude training, blood thins, and the amount of energy that gets consumed at higher altitudes is quite different than lower altitudes. The rest of the team had regular training at lower altitudes, and then 1 week training in Denver, Colorado, where we actually assembled. The team went from Denver to Mexico City in three groups. And at the time, I stayed with the last group and had Bobby Blum as organizer of the first group so that someone would be in charge in Mexico City.
Do you, kind of changing gears here a bit, do you remember much about the Olympic Project for Human Rights?
No.
No? You hadn't received a letter from the Harvard crew team or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
Don't recall ever seeing that.
And when you got to Mexico City, were you aware of the student protests there?
Well, I was aware of it before we got to Mexico City. I knew the student protest had happened. One of your interview points was about the, I can't even pronounce it, plateau or something like that, massacre. I had not been aware of that, but we did know that there was a issue with the students. And when we got to the Olympic Village in Mexico City, we found it surrounded by a big fence and a lot of armed guards. But they were in the background. They never really appeared in our village life.
Right. And did you ever worry about security? Was that an issue?
No.
Okay.
No, we had heard that the students had, and the Mexican government had come to an agreement that there would be no problems during the Olympics.
Now, during your stay there, did you have much of a chance to go sightseeing? What were some of your impressions of the city?
Well, very little sightseeing, actually. The team had a car. Well, I was the driver of it, so I took people around. As I said, we had to do a laundry run almost every day. Those white uniforms tend to get a little bit dirty in use. And so we had to go through Mexico to find the laundry. And there was very little off time. The manager's there for each and every event. So that a few times we were able to drive through Mexico City, and oddly enough, the car that we had seemed to have a problem with the Zocalo. Every time we got near it, the car would stutter and stammer, and heavens knows, almost stop. And as soon as we left, the car was fine again. I have no idea why that happened, but it certainly was curious. We found the people in Mexico to be very friendly. There were some folks, some very rich people that had a house in Mexico with a pool and so on. They invited the team members over, and that was one of the times that we were not in the village. Treated us very nicely, and we were trying to figure out how we could pay them in some way for this. And finally decided that we would give them a dinner in the Olympic Village, which was not accessible to them. And so they came and had a good time. And it happened to be the day that Beeman did his long jump and came into the dining hall with his medal beaming, absolutely beaming. I never saw a person so happy. One of the remembrances of Mexico.
Sure, sure. And you mentioned him. Did you have a chance to interact with him or any of the other athletes in some of the other sports?
Only in fencing. No, not other sports. I was focused entirely on fencing, keeping the team in one piece, making sure that they got to the practice sites on time. I was their chauffeur and back and forth. We did have one sad incident that cost us, I think, a medal. One of our featured fencers, Al Morales, saber fencer, the night before the competition, the elimination rounds, he wanted to get some water. In order to do that, he had to climb up to the cafeteria. It happened to have rained, and the steps were slippery, and he slipped and twisted his ankle.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning, when we were ready to go, here was one of our star players with a twisted ankle. Lots of luck. Fortunately, the Olympic Committee had a very good set of trainers, and the trainer came and fixed Al up so he could go through, and he went through the first preliminary rounds, but the ankle started to get worse, so by the time it got to the semifinals, Al was eliminated.
Mm-hmm.
It was an unfortunate situation.
Were there expectations to medal? What were the process?
Yes, Al Morales was really the strongest saber fencer that we had. We felt that if he had been healthy, we should have been in the medal count.
Mm-hmm.
But life was not to be like that.
Mm-hmm. Going back to before the competitions actually started, did you have a chance to attend the opening ceremony?
Yes, I did. I was also a judge, and as you're probably aware, there are different classifications, A, B, C, D, and so on. The athletes are F classification. The judges are D classification, which is a higher one. And with that declassification, I had seats right in front of the president for the Olympic opening ceremony.
Very nice.
except I wished I had been with the team.
Sure.
Actually, it was very interesting. The Mexicans had decided that they would get rid of this laissez-faire way that they're known, and so the Olympics were like clockwork. Everything started on time, everything was right, everything was there. It was amazing, and it was really something that the Mexicans did so well.
Now, the competition itself, how long did that last? I mean, fencing usually takes...
Well, it almost lasted the whole time period.
Yeah.
There was one day off in between. Aside from that, we started the competition on the first day of competition after the opening ceremonies the next day, and continued till the day before the closing ceremonies.
So it really was just all work, basically, the entire time there?
Right. These competitions were pools and... people qualified from the pools into the next round and so on.
And could you talk a little bit about the camaraderie amongst the fencers? What was that like?
It was excellent. The fencers themselves knew each other from a long time, and many friendships had already been established and just were there again. The fencers helped each other. When Morales twisted his ankle, the other members of his team stepped right in to see what they could do to help. And it was just first class. Dave Mechanic, as I remember, with the EPE team, was located in a different room on a different floor from us, And Dave kept people entertained, and it was just great.
Mm-hmm. Now, were the males and females training together? Were they part of the same cohort?
Well, we had five women on the team, and the women were sequestered in a separate facility.
Okay.
So in order to have somebody that had some authority there, I made Harriet King an assistant manager, and that way she could talk to the people who were in power with some authority and be able to get things done. I could not get anywhere near the women's quarters.
Is that right?
Well, this changed ultimately, but it was that way for several Olympiads. Men and women were sequestered.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Harriet did a great job, by the way.
Now, the Soviets had a very strong team in 68. Could you talk a little bit about your interactions with members of that team?
Sure. First of all, our fencers knew the Soviet fencers from the World Championship, so they had met before, and they weren't strangers by any means. But as it turned out, in the facility for the fencing itself, they had little places for each team, and it turned out that the Soviets were right next door to us. So we had a great opportunity of chatting with them whenever their keepers turned their back.
Mm-hmm.
The people met and talked to each other and worked with each other. All of them had some knowledge of French, so, and some other languages as well. So they were able to get along quite well. We had no problems with the Soviets at all.
So the conversations were then mostly in French then?
We were right next door to each other in those little, like cubicles, enough room for the team to spread out, put their equipment, and basically be there when we were called to compete.
Mm-hmm. And with members of the East German team, were there any interactions there?
Not in 68. Mm-hmm. 72 is another matter. That's another story, but that's not for this. I don't recall seeing any of the East Germans around. They may have been under more control than the Soviets were.
Mm.
Anyway, they were not close to us, hence we didn't really get to see them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were you aware of the list of banned substances at those Olympic Games?
Oh, yes. Fencing was one of the first sports to look at doping or the enhanced substance material. So we had already done a lot of testing, and our people knew about the controls, and they were aware of what needed to be done. And basically, they were clean.
Yeah. But how...
We had tested them even before we left.
Yeah. How far in advance were you testing before 68?
Oh, yeah. Well, we started as soon as the FIE, the Federation, the Fencing Federation International, as soon as they started, we began. We had a physician and a fencer who was very much involved in doping and doping controls. He was on the committee for the International Fencing Organization. And so we were kind of leaders in that kind of doping control.
Do you remember around what type of year it was?
Oh, that's a long time ago.
Sure, yeah.
44 years ago, since 68. And it was probably in the middle 60s, probably after 64.
Mm-hmm.
So it was probably in that Olympiad, that period between the two Olympiads, the 18th and 19th.
Right. So then were the athletes fairly used to it then, by 68?
Oh, yes. They knew they had to give it the office.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, when you're competing, you're completely perspiring and so on. So that made it a little bit problematic. We had to give them clean water and make sure that everything was okay.
Mm-hmm. Shifting gears again, with regard to the Black Power salute, is that something that you witnessed? Where and when were you when it happened, or when did you hear about it?
Well, we didn't hear about it until afterwards. The chief of mission was Miguel de Capriles. He was a fencer, so from Miguel after the Olympics, we knew more about it than before. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of rumors flying around at the time that most of them were probably wrong. It seemed, I believe, and that's only a feeling I had, is that the Mexican Olympic Committee was much more upset by this than the USOC was. The Mexicans felt that was a very damaging kind of thing for the Olympics, and so I think Miguel had to do a whole lot of diplomatic maneuvering to make sure that this wouldn't turn into something really bad.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, though. Was there anything specific that, you know, might have suggested that, or that made you think that way? Or was it just kind of like a sentiment that you felt?
I have no specific knowledge.
Yeah.
I know that the people were moved to a hotel very quickly, and that's the only knowledge I have. And after that, I'm not sure what took place, but most of it was for their protection and to kind of help smooth ruffled feathers.
Right.
I had another incident akin to the same thing. The team, as I mentioned, went to Mexico City in three waves. I was in the last wave, and just as I arrived, I was told to report immediately to the chief of mission, Miguel de Capriles, and I got bawled out because it seemed that one of our competitors, the oldest one, in fact, Uriah Jones, needed to get back into the rooms to go to the bathroom. And there was no one manning the desk where the keys were located. So Uriah, who was pretty big and bulky, broke the door down. And this, again, was one of those incidents that required Miguel's real diplomatic capabilities. The Mexican Olympic Committee was very upset.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction to the salute?
Well, I had no reaction. I'm sure if those two guys think back on it, they may say, well, okay. The Olympics were a focal point for all sorts of things. The student revolt, for example. Part of the reason they did it at the time that they did it, 5 days before the start of the Olympics, the student revolt basically was to get the world who was watching Mexico Olympics to see them and their grievances.
Mm.
So I think this was something that happens in 1972. You had another issue with the Palestinians. So these things, I think, are attracted by the Olympics. God bless the English. They did such a great job of theirs.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you think, do you think it should be politicized?
Well, in terms of history, I think it's something that was there. I'm not sure that the two guys really thought about the impact that they were causing with this. I think they were just simply trying to express their own sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
I can't judge it.
Mm-hmm.
Something that happened.
Yeah.
Smith and Carlos were good athletes. They obviously had won medals. And it wasn't really the occasion, I would have thought. But, you know, people at the Olympics are basically quite young, and so they act with their knowledge.
And it certainly received a lot of media attention, but I guess just turning to the media more broadly, what were your experiences like with them?
The media was a very interesting group. Before the Olympics, they had to dig up stories to figure out what they're doing. So one of the issues that came about was the sex test that was supposed to be made to show that women were really women.
Mm-hmm.
I think that had something to do with the East Bloc or East Germany. Anyway, Maxine Mitchell, who was one of our fencers, came to me and said, jokingly, I think, "What will I have to tell my grandchildren if I failed my sex test?" The reporter heard that, and the next thing we know, this was a big news item in San Francisco.
No kidding.
Where Maxine came from. Well, the reporters are all over the place, listening and trying to get stories, and it's really hard for them to do. In the meantime, the athletes are trying to get themselves warmed up and get ready for their competition. So the staff people kind of have to help in between and mediate.
Now, you mentioned Maxine Mitchell's kind of thoughts on gender verification. Was that something that a lot of athletes experienced that you knew?
It was the first time that it was being done, and as far as I know, it was just a DNA test, a very quick one.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody took it in good faith. If that was the rules, those were the rules.
Yeah.
So Maxine, of course, was joking about it, and it just was something we were talking.
Yeah. Now, there were a lot of record-setting events at the 68 Games. Do you have any specific memories of any in particular?
Well, I attended the fencing, so I didn't get to see much of the other events. And I only remember that one time when Beeman appeared, as I said, a real happy fellow with his medal around him, and he came through, and of course we all applauded.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know you said you didn't interact too much with some of the athletes from the other sports. Did you get any sense of togetherness amongst the U.S. team more generally?
Well, we were a pretty cohesive group, and we did a lot of things together when there was no competition, and those that had finished competition. We went to Tasco that day where there was no competition, and there was a bunch of us that piled into the car, and as many as we could squeeze in, and then we went down and had a nice trip and party.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of camaraderie.
Yeah.
Among the athletes and the staff.
Yeah. Are there any other experiences that stand out in your mind that you wanted to share? What was most memorable for you, looking back?
Well, looking back, being able to work with these wonderful folks, the manager has to do all the training, that is, get them ready for that training. The coaches do the actual training. But the manager has to make sure that everything works.
Mm-hmm.
And that it works smoothly, and that the athletes can focus entirely on their event and not have to worry about details of transportation, details of getting clean clothes, details of food, et cetera, et cetera. So that keeps a person pretty busy.
Yeah.
I have to admit that this was the first time that I was manager, and I got no information about the job content. For one thing, I wasn't even aware of how powerful a manager is in terms of the Olympic Committee. They're the big cheese in the Olympic Committee, and the competition, that is. As a result, I really didn't do enough for my team. I wish I had done more. I did in 72, but this one was my learning experience. So the staff people get selected. You can only do it for two Olympiads, and that's a short training time. So some of the things I remember from the point of view of a non-competitor.
Yeah, and you do have a unique view too, because I mean, once the athletes are competing, they're kind of in that zone. I imagine it was quite nerve-wracking.
One of the things that I did, I was able to get from the trainers some of those juices that have all sorts of chemicals in them. The trainer gave me a 5-gallon container with a stuff in it, and I've forgotten the name of it, but it's something that helps the athletes after they get off a competition, which is pretty tough. And I was carrying this material in one day when the head of the British team saw me and said to me, "I say, Bill, what do you got there, the team sample?" So, reference to the doping control. But Gatorade, that was the name of the material. So we had Gatorade. And for the first time in the 68 Olympics, we had been assigned with a trainer. That's one of the things I was able to get for the team. And that really helped. It helped a great deal with Morales particularly, but it helped just in general.
So you had a sport-specific trainer then?
I'm not sure that he was necessarily sport-specific, but he was good.
Yeah.
And so any kind of muscular issues, he knew how to handle. And if people get a cramp, which happens during competition sometimes, you get a certain time out. If you have a trainer available, that will shorten that time out, and so somebody can go back into competition again. The other thing that we did as a manager and staff people, when there was a problem on a strip, recently we saw that happening in the last Olympics, but when there's some sort of an issue, a call that's not right or that we feel is not right and we want to protest, either the manager or the team leader, whoever's there, will step in and protest. And since we had five people, four of which were competing on different splits, we kind of split up that job between Norman Lewis and myself.
Now, you'd mentioned having the chance to attend the opening ceremonies, the opening ceremony. Did you have a chance to attend the closing ceremony as well?
No, I left before that. I had to get back. I was working, and in fact, I was supposed to go to Hong Kong, and they got somebody else to go there in my stead. And then I was going to leave them, so I left as soon as the competition was finished.
Okay. And you mentioned going back, straight back to work after the games, but you stayed involved in fencing as well, obviously going on to work with the 72 team. Talk a little bit about keeping up in the sport in that post-68 period.
Well, as long as I could, I competed.
Yep.
And the best thing is if somebody knows the sport by doing it themselves. Fencing is one of those sports that you can do for a long, long time, and until the problems with age set in, you can do it. So I kept doing fencing throughout. It turned out, by the way, that one of our teammates, Albie Axelrod, worked for CBS as well. So CBS took the opportunity of having two people going down to Mexico City, and they used that as an internal kind of a news item. So Albie and I happened to be working for the same company.
About how long did you continue competing thereafter?
Oh, about 20 years.
Oh, wow.
Got some arthritis, and I couldn't really do the competition anymore. Unfortunately, life interferes sometimes with what you like to do.
Sure.
So I stayed with it for a long time, and every now and then I sort of swing my cane around to see if I could still fence.
How did those 72 games compare to the 68 games?
Well, I was much better in 72, having learned, and we were much better prepared. 72 games, if you're interested in them. There were a lot of things that happened. Cliff Buck was the chairman, and there were really a whole series of incidents that took place in 72. Our team did better. We were able to do more training in the interval in the 4 years between 68 and 72. We decided we wanted to get more medals. We did get better. Still not as good as we are today, but it was the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So 72 was an interesting Olympics in many, many ways, apart from the people that came that infamous Tuesday.
Mm-hmm. Reflecting back, I guess just on your career in the sport, who was the biggest influence of your career?
In my fencing, the biggest influence was Michel Allot. He was one of the coaches in 68. Michel was my coach also, and I think Michel really got me much more into what I could do, and really got me to a much higher level than I had been. So Michel was probably my biggest influence.
What were your personal experiences with the amateur issue, eligibility rules, gifts, things like that? I've heard some stories from other athletes saying that, you know, there were some issues. I wasn't sure if that was something that you had come across, too.
Oh, yes. Avery Brundage managed that one. An amateur, they felt, was someone who had no other contact than doing the sport for the love of it. Well, they're amateurs and they're amateurs. The Russians were amateurs, but they could fence every day because they were in the military, and so the government basically subsidized them. We couldn't do that. And that was unfortunate because we had some very, very good fencers that under the amateur rule couldn't compete, but it would have been excellent. So I'm glad that that rule got changed and that the provisions today of amateurism is much less stringent than it was in 68. I think that actually helps. These people, young people for the most part, need to get supported somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't fence in the way that a, quote, amateur, the rich gentry, could do it. And that's something that's recognized today, wasn't recognized then. Well, greatly unfortunate that they didn't. And would we have done better? I don't know. It's amazing how well we did under the rules as they existed.
Mm-hmm. What's one piece of advice that you would give to an Olympic hopeful today?
Well, it's a question of whether it's a competitor or if it's a staff member. For a competitor, I would say that training both the body and the mind, physical training and the training specific to the sport, but you also have to train to think. I have never seen a stupid athlete in the Olympics. The people there are really wonderful people. If I were hiring folks today, I would really hire an Olympian. So training the body and training the mind, I think, is the best thing for them. It's different for staff. They have a different job to do in the Olympics.
In your opinion, what effect do you think that the 68 Games had on the world of sport, or even the world more broadly?
What do I think of the 68 Games in the world of sport?
Yeah, what effect did they have, either in the world of sport or socially or culturally, politically?
Well, the games are supposed to be non-political, but they... That's an invention. The 68 games were in advance over previous games. Some of the equipment that was used was better. The timing was better. The electronic equipment was better. Even the sport itself had benefited from research that was being done between the Olympiads, and the methodology changed. The competitors in 1968 in fencing fenced a totally different form from the competitors today. It is very different, and that is just the evolution. I think the Olympics are a great way to evolve sports of various types.
All right, that was actually my final question, but I did want to leave it open if you wanted to add anything yourself.
No, I think we've been through a whole lot of stuff here that is really important to keep in mind. I think it's wonderful that we do this kind of thing and record it, and record something from people who were there at the time. It would really be helpful for you to do the same thing with the current Olympics, where memories are a little bit fresher and where people can think about issues that they need to resolve so that we can learn from them and do better next time.
Well, I did want to thank you again for taking the time to share some of your memories. It's obviously a very, very cool experience for me personally and for all of us who are working on this project.
Well, I wish you luck with it. I think it's an excellent project. And as a researcher myself, I can see where this will help a great deal of clarifying things and eliminating some misunderstandings.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much.
Alrighty, thank you.